you again.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. We've got a great episode of a bit of talk, a bit of music here for you all this morning. It's a beautiful Tuesday morning. And to start off, before we get into any of the interviews that we have planned for this hour, which, by the way, include a interview with Autumn of Collective Disorder in about 30 minutes, so make sure you stay tuned for that. But before then, let's play some music. This is I'll Follow by Computer.
Thank you.
Once again, that was I'll Follow by the band Computer, local to Vancouver. And coming up next, we have an interview I did with SFU Biological Sciences professor Michael Price. Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. A recently released study from the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences has identified a stark decrease in the monitoring of Pacific salmon populations over the past two decades. According to the study, this erosion in population data greatly decreases the ability of scientists to determine the status of close to half of Pacific salmon populations. To learn more about the implications of this monitoring decrease, as well as why it's been occurring, we spoke with Michael Price, adjunct professor of biological sciences at Simon Fraser University and co-author of this recent study. Please take a listen.
Well, this short abstract of it, without getting too much into the weeds, 2025, when we performed the research, it was the 20th anniversary of a groundbreaking policy of the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Canada. They adopted what's known as the Wild Salmon Policy. So in 2005, this was initiated, and it was a new direction for salmon conservation. The conservation of salmon was seen as the highest priority above all other users, First Nations, recreation fishers, commercial fishing. It's conservation first and foremost. And then if there's an abundance of salmon, it goes down the line. So anyway, this was a transformative approach for Canada. And again, this being the 20th anniversary, it was trying to assess, well, how are salmon better off? How are we doing when it comes to adhering to the policy? And one of the primary pillars of the wild salmon policy is to assess the health of wild salmon populations. So we wanted to know, are we gathering the necessary information to assess the health of salmon populations? And that those fundamental data, or the fundamental information really, are the annual counts of salmon returning to spawning streams throughout British Columbia and the Yukon. So this is for Pacific salmon, Western Canada. That was the nuts and bolts of it. Here we are 20 years later. Are we better off? Are we acquiring the necessary information? Have we improved over the last 20 years in terms of the amount of information we're gathering on salmon to assess their health? And in doing so, if we assess them as being at risk, then we can make informed decisions of how to turn the tide, how to improve the state for salmon. So that was the context for this work.
What were the, I guess, specific findings of the research in particular? I noticed that like one major thing that was brought up was this, what is being seen as a decline in monitoring regarding local salmon populations.
So over these last 20 years, yes, so we took it a step further. We looked at, how many spawning populations do we have annual estimates for, annual counts of the number of fish returning to these populations. And then how does that translate into how many populations can we assess their health? And we used a specific index like each generation, say, of time, and how that's changed. So we can say that the amount of information we're gathering on salmon has declined by roughly a third over the last 20 years. It's been declining steeply since the mid-1980s. So we're now at essentially the lowest level ever. Since 1950, we're now counting the least number of spawning populations than we really ever have. And how that translates to how many populations can we today assess the health of? And the answer is roughly 50%. or 55%. So we can only really tell the health of half of British Columbia and Yukon's populations. Those are the major findings. So for the other 50%, we have no idea, really, not necessarily for all of them, but for some of them, we don't even know if they continue to exist. We're no longer looking. That's the most worrying. The next level up from that is we don't know if those populations that we no longer have information for, are they declining? Are they at risk? And on the flip side of that is, might some of these be healthy, but because we don't know that they're healthy, there may be fishing opportunities that are no longer there out of an abundance of caution. So it kind of works two ways. In one way, if we don't have the information, we might be making fisheries decisions in the dark. We may be saying, yes, go ahead, go fishing out in the ocean, and we may be impacting populations that can't withstand those fisheries. But on the flip side of that is we may be saying, don't go fishing because we don't have any information, where actually they may be able to sustain some fishing pressure. So it works two ways. And then third, I'll just finish with saying, and this kind of relates to what's happening today, you know, the federal government is now fast-tracking industrial projects, and several of those industrial projects slated for fast-tracking occur in northern watersheds like the Skeena. So at the, you know, the time that we're trying to bring some industrial projects to fruition, whether these are pipelines or transmission projects or mining projects, we're losing our ability to assess whether these projects will actually harm salmon or not. So we're essentially making a lot of decisions in the dark, and that does not bode well for salmon.
Why do you think that this has been occurring? Like, what has led to this decrease in monitoring and tracking of Western salmon populations?
Largely, I would say it's a lack of priority. So it's not because of lack of funding. And we can see that because in 2021, the federal government injected almost $700 million new money into a specific initiative for salmon conservation. And the activities that they've undertaken over the last 5 years, they basically spent all the money, $700 million. Salmon monitoring was not a priority. Enhancement was, harvest transformation, or like the buying back of fishing vessels or aquaculture. These things have been prioritized, whereas salmon monitoring hasn't. So it's basically a lack of priority. I don't know if it's a lack of understanding of how important this basic information is. I can't see that being true. I think all salmon biologists recognize the need for information to assess the health of populations, but maybe the upper echelon of, you know, into the politics, they may not be interested in monitoring, interested in knowing how healthy salmon populations are, because they need to act on it. If they did know how healthy these populations are.
Mm-hmm. I noticed in part of the article, you're quoted as saying part of the solution would include strengthening Indigenous-led and community-based data collection. I was wondering if you could explain that a bit, what that would entail, what that would look like, essentially.
Well, it's starting to happen. It's been happening over the last number of years, probably kick-started with the wild salmon policy and the recognition that DFO can't do it alone. But also knowing, you know, given the remoteness of many salmon spawning streams on especially the central and north coast of British Columbia and into the Yukon, there are many Indigenous communities that reside in these remote areas, and they have been active stewards of this resource for thousands of years. So it's really a transferring back of that stewardship to local communities. So that has been happening, where local Indigenous communities are starting to, are doing some of that monitoring. They are going into salmon spawning streams and counting them. So it's more of that. It's transferring more of that stewardship to local Indigenous communities, allowing them, providing them the capacity to do that. And it does two things. One, it enables salmon to be monitored in some of the remote regions of our province. But two, it also provides capacity for often underemployed communities. So I feel there's a real missed opportunity beyond salmon conservation and turning the tide and ensuring that salmon populations don't decline and become extinct, which some are and some have. It's also empowering local communities to, again, be more active stewards and, you know, be that primary steward of the resource.
One other question I had was regarding the specific species of salmon that need monitoring and determining of where their health is at. One specific type of salmon in particular that was referenced was sockeye. And I'm wondering if there's any specific reason as to why the health or the data around the health of sockeye is something that is lacking in particular.
Well, it's interesting. Sockeye salmon have been, like, when commercial fisheries began in the late 1800s, sockeye were the primary species. Their red flesh was the first to be marketed. They could put it into cans. People recognized that. It actually took a while for pink salmon and chum salmon, who have much lighter flesh, to be accepted by the public and marketable. That didn't happen until the war years, when they literally needed to provide food for the troops. And so part of my PhD research used the scales from sockeye salmon dating back to the early 1900s. So in some ways we have the most amount of information on sockeye salmon compared to all other species. But when it comes to monitoring, the challenge with sockeye is they're the one species that those spawning fish literally go back to the place of their birth. They don't often stray. They don't often go into other rivers that they were not born in to spawn. So they have very high genetic uniqueness. So almost, if you can think of it as every spawning stream has a genetically unique sockeye population. Whereas other species like chum salmon or Chinook salmon or pink salmon, these populations consist of, at times, hundreds of spawning populations. So because they stray so often, they have a lot of genetic mixing. So sockeye salmon actually have the most number of unique populations. They're actually called conservation units. It's a different level of population. So a sockeye conservation unit, again, may just have one spawning population, and there are some 200 of those, say, in the province. Whereas a given Chinook salmon conservation unit might consist of over 100 spawning populations. So it's much easier for us to, and this is the way, it was a conservative way that we assessed whether we have enough information on a given conservation unit. As long as one spawning population for Chinook within a conservation unit that may have hundreds of spawning populations, as long as one was counted, we said, check, you have enough information to assess its health. That's, you know, we could go into the weeds, which we didn't, about whether that's adequate or not. We don't. But that's why, for a lot of these sockeye conservation units, they're in very remote places that are admittedly difficult to monitor and count. And so it's actually, that's what, you know, kind of, if we say there's a lack of monitoring for sockeye salmon, That's why. Proportionately, that's not true. Really, they're about even across all species. It's not that we're targeting sockeye salmon and saying, let's not, you know, count those fish, because actually they still remain an economically, but also culturally important species. Like to First Nations, they're right there at the top. Chinook and sockeye for First Nations, particularly in the Skeena where I'm at with the Wet'suwet'en, those are the two species that elders wish for. You know, coho are not desired. So there is a priority to monitor them, but they're difficult and they're genetically unique. So there's a lot of them. So proportionally, they're the least monitored.
I think I have one last question for you about this, which would be, with research studies such as the one that you helped write, as well as others that are studying similar things regarding the monitoring of West Coast salmon, do you have hope that that work is going to help influence things in the right direction?
Yes, of course I have hope. I mean, that's the primary reason for doing it. It's like you want to create change. You want to improve, excuse me, the situation. And, you know, one source of inspiration of hope is the, you know, what we call boots on the ground, the biologists, stock assessment biologists in particular. That's kind of a division within Fisheries and Oceans Canada. They're responsible for assessing, making sure we have the information required to assess populations. That is their desire, that they have more information. And unfortunately, that there again speaks to the priority of the department as a whole. And the department is responsible for shellfish and other marine fish. So they have a big portfolio, salmon only being one of them. But this stock assessment division has been receiving less and less money to do the necessary work. Well, I feel like, yeah, there are a lot of individuals that desire this change. And also, I think if we can make the case for these opportunities, these local stewardship opportunities for local communities to be more active stewards and monitors of salmon, I think that's the direction that we need to go. So yes, I have hope. I have hope, even though, you know, a recent study, so I said about 50% of the populations, we really don't have the information to assess their health. Well, of the half that we do, roughly 70% are considered to be in decline. So salmon are in trouble. There's no doubt about that. But where I have hope is, you know, when we do give them a chance, when we do make informed decisions, they can rebound. Salmon are super resilient animals. So I think they'll be there in the future. It really just depends on our everyday decisions and whether they're in the best interest of salmon or not. So, yeah, I have hope for salmon. I have hope that this... you know, this is kind of like a report card. It's providing a report card to the department of where things are at when it comes to collecting the necessary information on salmon. And hopefully they'll respond positively. But I don't think this alone will do that. I think the public needs to, you know, we need to put as much pressure on the government as possible to create that change, whether it's for monitoring or whether it's for salmon conservation broadly or whether it's for, you know, the health of the natural world. It's really down to you and I, Danny, to put pressure on those that make these decisions.
Once again, that was our conversation on decreased monitoring of Pacific salmon populations with Michael Price, a conservation scientist and adjunct professor of biological sciences at Simon Fraser University. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. All right, we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Danny Nezvedarani once again, your community journalist, and I'm here live in studio now with a very special guest, Autumn Jean Cairns, a multidisciplinary artist and curator of Collector Disorder. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me. I've always had two dreams. One of them is to get to blow the horn on a train, and the other is to be on the air. So I've finally achieved one of them.
Well, again, thank you for so much for coming up live. I know it can be a little weird getting up here up on Burnaby Mountain. But to start, why are you here? What are we here to talk about today?
Well, we're here because the 3-year anniversary show of Collective Disorder is coming up. It's called Disorder X because it's the 10th disorder show to happen at Redgate Art Society. And it's a beautiful and vibrant queer arts variety showcase that I'm so excited to be putting on and so excited to be here talking about it with you.
Mm-hmm. First question I have is, give me a background of Collective Disorder. How did it get started? What does it encapsulate?
Yeah, sure. So the first disorder show was, about 3 years ago. I actually immigrated to Canada from the U.S. about 4 years ago. And when I got here, I went to school for art in Tallahassee, Florida, and there I really fell in love with performance art and all the different ways that you can be experimental on stage. And, you know, in my background, I had been a visual artist doing drawing and painting, which I still love, but there's something about the kind of visceral nature of performance art, of connecting with an audience live in person in a way that is experimental. It's not quite theater, it's not quite music, but it overlaps with all these things. And then when I moved here and I got really involved in the DIY music scene, and I was like, for one thing, this is queer as hell, and I love it. Just so many queer and trans folks in this city that are artistic and creative and enthusiastic. And I was meeting so many bands and going to so many shows, and I was like, I feel that the art that I practice and that I fell in love with in Florida, performance art, would be so amazing sharing a stage with this music, because there's a shared sense of like the kind of punk, experimental, we're going our own way. So the first disorder show, my idea behind it was blending performance art and music. We had some experimental musicians. We had some performance art. And it's really just blossomed since there, where each subsequent show I've gotten to meet more and more people from different disciplines in the art scene, poets and comedians and actors and playwrights and clowns and drag queens. Like, the variety is incredible. And so my goal with Collective Disorder is to be a home for these live events that can bring people together in the community to share in all of this incredible diversity. There can be work that makes you laugh. There can be work that makes you cry. There can be work that makes you want to get up and dance, or even mosh a little bit. And just like providing that sense of, there's a place where you can go as an artist and as an audience member to be seen and to share what you make and to have it shared with you. And it's, you know, it's one of the best things that I've ever found to be able to do that work.
That is so cool. I can't even, you know, I can't even be eloquent or professional right now. That is just very, very cool.
Aww.
And one thing I was curious about is, you said you are from Florida originally, mm-hmm. and I'm curious as to what attracted you to Vancouver specifically.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, I had a lot of really interesting things happen in my life all at once at the beginning of 2020, you know, I was in my final semester of getting my BFA in studio art. And in March, in February, I had my first ever solo show where I did my first piece of performance art. And then in March, I started transitioning, and also COVID hit. So I had a bunch of these life-changing things happen at once where I found a new direction for my art to go. I found a new direction for me to go. And then also the entire world decided to go in a new direction. And it was all happening at once. And so after I graduated and, you know, I had some time to kind of figure out myself, I was like, I feel like I'm ready to start fresh somewhere. And, you know, even in Tallahassee, like, Vancouver has such a great reputation of being a center for the arts. And then, you know, I also met my future wife online. And so I knew that I wanted to go somewhere. And then when that happened, that was like, okay, now I know where I want to go, where I want my landing to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how long did it take you, I guess, to figure out the scene in Vancouver, where you wanted to fit in and where your community was, essentially?
Oh, I mean, I definitely feel like it's an ongoing process, you know? I feel the same way about that. Sometimes people ask me, does Canada feel like home now? And it's like, there's never been a kind of binary, is it or is it not? Like, have I found community or haven't I? It's more of like a ever-shifting kind of organic process. And yeah, so when I moved here again, I got really involved in the DIY music scene. I was going to shows a lot. I was meeting a lot of bands. There's a lot of amazing bands in Vancouver. And I had the sense of like, I want to bring my work here, and I don't really know how to do that. And the best way that I could figure out to do it was to just be like, you know, okay, I'm just going to make a show and perform in it. You know, I definitely, whether it's having an eclectic sensibility or whether it's just having ADHD, I love to get involved in different fields all the time and take inspiration from different things. So, you know, in the last like year and a half, I've gotten really involved in the comedy scene. There's some amazing queer art in Vancouver and people who are so funny. And that's been kind of nice for me because a lot of my performance artwork can be on themes that are, you know, very heavy. And I think for me, finding a good life balance of I can make that work, but then I can also go to shows and tell jokes and make people laugh. I mean, I feel like I definitely feel like I have community. And I also feel like I'm continuing to find it more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with disorder, it's both building community for the people around me, for the artists and for just queer folks here in the city. And it's also community building for me. It's a very kind of personal thing for me of feeling like I'm putting roots down here as well.
Yeah. You know, earlier you had mentioned the different types of performances and different mediums that people are playing with and showcasing at Collective Disorder. How, I'm sure that's an involved process, sort of curating where each part fits, you know, like, oh, should there be a comedian here? Should there be a performance artist here? Or when mm-hmm. should the band play? You know, how does that sort of work for you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's kind of my favorite part is figuring out what is this individual show going to look like? And you know, this is Disorder X, it's the 10th one, so I've had a lot of kind of trial and error of figuring out what goes really well together. And because I found that it can be a lot more inviting to people to experience something that is experimental or vulnerable or heavy when you can have a sense of catharsis where you're not just left feeling those heavy things, you've also been able to release them. And so I've found the way that I usually like to do it is starting the night off with comedy, with poetry, stuff that's a little bit more lighthearted, and ending the night with local bands, indie rock or punk, so you can get up and dance and shake it off and go home feeling really like positive and optimistic and sweaty. And then in between getting to have work that is maybe a bit more vulnerable, maybe a bit heavier. And because, again, it's like that's kind of that's the performance work that really speaks to me. And so I love to have people, you know, come to a show and get, you know, kind of like warmed up with like some comedy, laugh, and especially laugh about like queer stuff, because I've been to comedy shows in Vancouver that are like not for queer audiences and shows that are. And it's so funny how much like just kind of there's like a lack of beating around the bush. We can just kind of get to like, oh, what's the stuff that queer people find funny, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that kind of like warms people up. And then we can do some stuff that's a little bit, you know, you want to sit and watch and like let it sit a little bit, and then get up and dance.
Yeah. How would you say Collective Disorder has changed now from the upcoming 10th show to its very first show? How would you say it's progressed or morphed in any way?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've certainly grown and changed a lot as a person doing this, and I feel like I've really, you know, grown a lot of wisdom in, because so part of it is like, we as artists and as queer folks and as queer artists, there's so much really powerful emotion that we feel just living in the world and reading the news and seeing what's happening. And it's been a hard year of, you know, war and death and horrible, horrible things happening. And that's so heavy to live with. And it can be really difficult to find a way to process and express those feelings in a way that is, you know, I think that a lot of us can have a sense of like, we want to lash out at the injustice in the world. And how do we get on stage and do that lashing out, but not at the people who are there watching us? And I've certainly grown in that a lot, where I think like when I was younger, some of my work was a bit more kind of abrasive, because I had a lot of sort of anger at seeing the way that the world is and anger at the way that queer people are treated. And so there's been a softening as well of like, we can express rage together, we can express grief together, but we can also laugh together and we can smile together and we can, you know, we can go through it all sort of as a community. And I think that's, for me, I think been the biggest thing. But then there's also, you know, the kind of network of artists who put their incredible work on stage at the show has grown a lot. And what feels possible to do has grown a lot as well. I mean, we've had everything from, we had a trans femme indie rock artist do her estrogen injection live on stage. We had a set where there was a duo that did, one of them was doing a stick and poke tattoo on the other with a contact mic hooked up to the needle so that they could make a noise set out of the sound of themselves being tattooed.
Oh, that is so rad.
So, what the show can be and what we're able to do has grown so much, and it just makes me that much more excited for, you know, Disorder 11 and onward, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way you're describing it is that it's, yeah, it's not one singular thing. And it, when you said, like, lashing out, you know, you're not lashing out at the audience. It's sort of like a collective catharsis.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, so, you know, my body of work has changed a lot in the last few years. I used to, when I was younger, I did a lot of like nature drawing and painting and kind of relating like the natural world and our like physical forms to the cosmos. And so I was drawing like butterflies and the moon and bones and all these things. And then it kind of became more abstract as I was looking more inward and being like, what's my subjective experience? And now that I've really, you know, kind of come into my own as a performance artist, I've really found so much value in researching ritual, because, you know, humanity evolved in tribes and villages and communities. And since time immemorial, we have collectively dealt with, you know, big emotions, whether, you know, joyous or sad, in community and through ritual. And there's a sense of place, there's a sense of, you know, particular cultures in particular places have particular rituals. And there's been such an erosion of that over the centuries. And even very recently, in the last 100, 150 years, there's been a lot of traditional rituals that have really fallen by the wayside. So my work, especially looking back, you know, my heritage is sort of Gaelic and Germanic. And so I've been trying to look back and revitalize and recontextualize these rituals, where when you experience grief, as so many of us have, again, just seeing the state of the world, but when you experience great joy as well, the joy of being who you are and the joy of being alive, these are things that are meant to be shared, and they're meant to be acted out and to have, you know, a ritual in the sense of there are things you can do to express these feelings, to have it be witnessed, and to then be let go. And then you walk away feeling lighter. So I feel like I really try to bring that kind of energy to the shows in general, but especially to my work of, you know, this piece that I'm going to do at this show. There's a lot of emphasis on the idea of, like, grief and ritual as labor, as work you do, as a burden that you carry. Like, the Latin root word for grief means burden. And then you carry it, and then you can set it down. And you can have that burden be shared. And then you can go outside for a smoke break, come back in, and rock out to some indie rock. So, you know, So it's a whole experience.
Yeah, so even you saying that, like, there isn't this expectation that people's eyes must be glued to the performer at all seconds. And like, you know, it is very much sort of like a chill, like, come in, come out kind of environment.
Well, we definitely, you know, the hope is that people will, you know, will stay and be there with the art, right? But there's also a sense of, like, we want this space to be safe. Yeah. We want you to engage in a way that feels right for you. And that's part of why there's that sense of, like, we're also going to have comedy, and we're also going to have music, and we're also going to have, like, poetry that feels vulnerable. And I think that, you know, my job as curator is to create a space where you feel safe and encouraged as much as possible to get to be a part of all of it. But yeah, absolutely. You know, it's like, you got to take care of yourself first and foremost. You got to listen to your body. And bring a friend and sit there and be together with people that you love and care about. You know, bring a date, have an awesome first date experience. Like, yeah, I think I've been so grateful to see the ways that people who have come to these shows before, they have this, there's an incredible sense of trust that I feel, where they're like, I don't know what to expect from this one, but I'm excited for it. And I'm like, hell yes, that's exactly what I was hoping for, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they sort of put their trust in you as a curator to put together this really cool show of just different eclectic forms of art and performers.
And I that's something that I really strive for, and I really don't take for granted, because it's also with the artists, you know. I was talking to one of the artists who's a poet, and I was like, I want to invite you, if you feel like you want to share work that is vulnerable, that maybe you don't feel comfortable sharing at another space, but there's no pressure, you know? It's whatever feels right. And there's so much room to, if you want to share poetry that's lighthearted and fun and quirky and makes you laugh, then go for it. And if you want to share stuff that's like, a little bit more raw or a little bit heavier, you can go for that too. And there's a sense of, I really try to earn that trust. And I feel really honored when people want to share that stuff, or people want to share things that are a little bit more experimental, or, you know, oh, there's this thing that I've been wanting to try that's a little outside my wheelhouse, and I'm like, hell yes, this is the perfect place to give it a shot, you know?
Absolutely. Speaking of the artists, I was wondering if you'd be able to, I guess, just go over a little bit about the specific performers for Disorder X.
Oh, Danny, I would love to. So the show is going to be hosted by Arya Afshar, a dear friend of mine. They are genuinely one of the funniest people that I know. They're going to MC the event. They've appeared on Just for Laughs Vancouver and they were featured on Vancouver Guardian's Comedy Spotlight. Then doing a comedy set, we have Carmen Lee. And in their work with Community Clowns, they produce Open Michelle, which is a queer open mic. And they also produce Lie Comedy, a monthly Asian comic showcase. She's amazing. She's so good at that balance between like making people laugh and making people cry. We have Sayer Cedar doing a spoken word performance. They are an Indigenous, Two-Spirit, queer poet and author. I just had the pleasure of doing a show with them a few days ago that was a comedy poetry slam where it was like comedians were invited to do poetry and poets were invited to do comedy. And they were just amazing at it. We have Nora Vision, who you might know as one of the producers, as well as the host of Attention Whores and Slag Race. She's an amazing drag queen, but she's also a playwright whose work uses science fiction to explore themes like class structure, internet culture, queer rebellion. So she's going to be performing a scene from her play. Myself, I will be performing mononymously as Cairns. And I really just wanted the opportunity to say the word mononymously. that's my stage name when I do performance art. And I'll be collaborating with How to Survive a High-Rise Hotel Fire. They are disorder veterans. They performed at the first show. We did a piece together. It's a collective started by bassist Nico Whitworth and oboist Haley Bird, somewhere between noise and free jazz. Then we're going to take a little intermission. We're going to move the couches back, make a dance floor, and then we'll have Doom Loops, a queer-fronted indie rock band, somewhere between dreamy nostalgia and energetic punk. I always describe it as, I love my friends' music. And then finally, headlining the show is Tall Mary. They are an amazing queer noise punk band who play their guitars with awls. Like you would do bookbinding, punching through stuff with. So we got stuff that's experimental. We got stuff that's silly. We got stuff that's, you know, poignant. So I'm so, so jazzed. I think it's such a stacked lineup. And I really hope people come out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you sounded really jazzed to be able to speak about each of these artists.
Oh, I am.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, you know, with some of these people being people that have performed before, would you say these are like friends almost at this point?
Oh, 100%. I had to stop myself from being like, with every one of them being like, so this is my close personal friend and they love me so much. No, definitely. They're all friends. And yeah, some of them have performed multiple times at Disorder. Like I said, Hotel Fire, they performed at the first one. They were the ones who were doing that noise piece with the stick and poke I was telling you about. But then I also have some folks like Sayer and Nora who I've seen perform or been in shows with but who have not performed at Disorder before. And I always try to bring in new folks to these shows as well so that there's something familiar and there's something unfamiliar, something new. But yeah, I mean, I'm genuinely just as excited to get to be there and watch them perform as I am to share the stage and be a performer with them, because I just like... For some of it, it's like I've seen them play before. They're so tight, and I know what to expect, and I'm jazzed for it. And then there's some Nora doing her theater piece. I'm like, I have so much trust in her as a performer, and I haven't seen it before, so I'm so excited to get to see it. You know, for the first time alongside the audience. You know.
Oh man, yeah. So I mean, this is a show for you as much as anyone else.
Oh, I mean, 100%. You got to do it for you as well, you know. And I mean, like I was saying before, it's very much like a personal community building thing for me as well. So yeah, believe it. I'm gonna be sitting there in the front row, you know, shoveling popcorn into my mouth. Not actually. I don't think there's a popcorn machine at, you know,
at Red Gate.
At Red Gate. Mm-hmm. I will be having probably a nice gin and tonic or something.
Nice, nice. If someone wants to get involved in the performance aspect of Collective Disorder, how would they do that? Do they just email you?
They can, yeah, email me, hit me up. You can follow me on Instagram at Cairns_art_. That's CAIRNS. You can send me a message there. You can also follow Collective Disorder at Collective_Disorder. Yeah, if you have something you want to share, if you're, you know, whether you've been on stage before or whether it's your first time, these kind of main number disorder shows, I really like to reach out to people who are experienced in the art scene. But I also am, you know, wanting to put together other shows as well. You know, I did an open mic last year where it was totally free for anyone to come in, you know, whether you've performed before or not. And I want to continue to make more spaces like that. So if you have something you want to share in any genre, in any medium, feel free to hit me up and let me know what you've got cooking, and let's talk. I want to see it.
All right, that's so awesome to hear. I mean, I think one thing that, and I think I have a bad proclivity of comparing everything to community radio, but in this case, I do think it is really awesome to have spaces that are low barrier, that allow people to sort of experiment and express themselves publicly without having sort of this background or need to be... trying to find the right word for it, considered as professional.
No, 100%. I know what you mean. Yeah, that sense of being established.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, we talk so much about like when you apply for a job and it's like you need a year experience, you need 2 years experience. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm trying to get the experience by applying, you know? And it's tough because, you know, so often the barriers that we experience coming up in a particular scene, they get reinforced as people get older and as we, you know, that's part of the reason why when I lived in Tallahassee and I was going to school, there was a lot of emphasis on like the gallery space and the fine arts world, which I have a tremendous amount of respect and love for. And I have some friends who have gone on to do amazingly well for themselves doing the gallery circuit. And I think that for me, the passion that I've found is in these kind of, you know, underground spaces, because there's so much just bubbling up that is kind of unseen in the mainstream. And it's kind of like, you know, I know you're a big fan of music, obviously. It's kind of like you were talking before about sometimes you'll pull something off the shelf, like a record, and be like, oh, this is a album from 1994 from a band that never released anything. And it's like, being in that space and being like, who has an amazing voice but is not being heard? Mm-hmm. Who has something to share that is not being seen? There's more stuff there than you could ever experience in a lifetime. And so giving it platforms and encouraging people, take that step, take the risk, be experimental, do the thing that... What do you feel like deeply that's like, I'm yearning to do this, and I don't know how, and I don't know where? You know, get out there and ask questions. And I love to be a resource. Someone literally messaged me yesterday being like, hey, do you know any places that are good for like first time comedy stuff? And I was like, yeah, dude, I got you. Like, let's hook you up. Let's get you on stage. And the other thing as well is that the finding out that there's so many other spaces as well. You know, doing comedy, I've found these shows like Open Michelle that Carmen runs, Gender Neutral Comedy Hour, Laughs and Queer. These are open mics that it's encouraged. You don't need any experience. You just need to you know, have a wish of wanting to make people laugh. And there's spaces like that for music and for poetry. And, you know, we need it as artists. We need people coming in. We need to hear what you have to say. We need to know what, you know, we need to hear your voices. Because that's like, I hate to say the next generation, because I'm only 27 and I feel like that makes me sound so, it makes me sound like Master Yoda. But, you know, that next generation of artists coming in, you know, we want you to come in. And I want to lower the barriers or get rid of them entirely so that you feel welcomed into the space without having, as you were saying, without having to feel like that sense of established professionalism. Mm-hmm. You haven't gotten there until you've gotten there, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I'm curious as well. We have about 6 minutes left, but one thing I was really curious about is the kind of feedback or reception that you're hearing from people like actually attending. And if you've heard anything in particular that's like really stuck out to you, it's like, oh, what I'm doing is really good.
You know, it is, for me, it's such a tremendous privilege when someone comes up to me after the show and they tell me that that it made them cry. You know, that's such an honor to, because it means that you came into it with an open heart. It means that you came into it and you were curious and you wanted to experience the art that we're putting out there, and that you as an audience member were willing to let your guard down and be vulnerable with us. So when people are willing to like share their tears, that's so meaningful to me, and I really love and honor that. But very much also, people will just come up to me and say, you know, it was great, I laughed so much. Or when I see people like, you know, be a little bit of a mosh pit and during the punk sections. I think it's also something that is very meaningful to me is when people tell me that they feel like they haven't experienced something like disorder. And because, you know, I think a lot of us, we've gone to music shows, we've gone to comedy shows. But, you know, what I hope with disorder is to spotlight that diversity and that variety, because there's so much, and I think there's so much beauty to be made by letting all of these things share a space together and be in conversation with each other and have an ebb and flow between these different mediums. So when people come up and they say, you know, I didn't know that this was a thing you could do, I've never been to a show like this before, and I want to go to the next one, That means everything to me. You know, that's what I do it for, is to get people to want to come to the next one. And then also, yeah, I've definitely had people who are like, yo, I want to be in it. I've got this sick band.
I'm a star.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, like, let's do it. Let's make it happen. There's never enough hours in the day. There's never enough time to make it all happen. But I really, really try to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I guess finally, with the time that we have left, when, where, how? Explain.
These are, you know, Danny, you're such a great interviewer. These are amazing questions. So the when is Sunday, February 8th. Doors are at 7 p.m. The show starts at 8. The location is Redgate Art Society at 1965 Main Street. Tickets are only $15 available at the door. But there's a pay what you can option available if you just hit up the venue. You can message them on Instagram and get added to their pay what you can list. Just make sure to do that ahead of time before the show. And then pay what you can is available. And they've also got their accessibility info available on their website. It's, you know, it's less than 2 weeks away. The time always melts away, because I try to get started on these shows usually 3 or 4 months ahead of time. And I'm like, oh, it's, you know, days. And I've done so much, but I feel like there's still so much to do. I have to, for my performance, just as a little hint of what I'm going to be doing, I need to drive my car down to a riverbed in North Vancouver and load it up with a ton of rocks and drive it back down to the venue and load them up. So I've got my work cut out for me.
That's a lot of intrigue that you've dropped there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. There will be lots of queer indie rock, but there will also be lots of literal rocks. Be excited.
Wow. Okay. North Vancouver rocks, too, specifically.
They're the, like, smooth river stones.
Right,
and, which are, they're just so nice. And, you know, not trying to get pebbles here. I'm trying to get stones.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in North Vancouver, so I'm aware of the,
you know,
the big river stones.
You know, North Vancouver river stones represent.
For real. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Autumn, for coming down here to CJSF, or coming up here, I guess, in this case.
Yes, it was quite the hike. Thank you so much for having me, Danny. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate it. And if you're listening, come out to Disorder X. It's going to be a great time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do it. Come out to Disorder X, February 8th, Redgate Art Society. It's going to be a great time.
Oh my God, that was great.